Good evening. The United States pulls its troops out of Germany, moving the North Atlantic Treaty Organization closer to Russia's borders. NYPD's Warren Squad snatches a protester during a march in Manhattan, raising fears of a secret police operation, while activists say they'll sue to get police misconduct files released. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. News agencies report deaths from COVID-19 surpassed 150,000 in the United States on Wednesday, more than any other country and nearly a quarter of the world's total. And the increase of 10,000 COVID-19 deaths over the last 11 days is the fastest in the United States since early June. Meanwhile, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo added Illinois, Kentucky, Minnesota, and Washington, D.C. to a list of states where visitors must quarantine if they visit the state. There are now 34 states on the list as coronavirus cases continue to climb. Travelers who refuse to self-report can be fined up to $2,000. And John Lewis was lauded as a warrior and hero during a ceremony at the Georgia Capitol today. The civil rights icon will lie in repose in one of the last memorials before he's buried. People lined the streets as the hearse carrying Lewis's body moved through downtown. It stopped briefly in front of a mural of Lewis with the word hero before arriving at the state capitol. Yesterday, Lewis's coffin lay in state in the national capitol, a day after being carried across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Montgomery, Alabama, where Lewis had been beaten by police with civil rights marchers in 1965. President Trump has notably skipped the memorials to Lewis. The summer's third and final mission to Mars, featuring NASA's most elaborate life-hunting rover, is on the verge of liftoff. The rover Perseverance will follow China's rover orbiter Combo and a United Arab Emirates orbiter, both launched earlier this week. It will take the spacecraft 7 months to reach Mars after traveling 300 million miles. There, the rover will search for signs that life once existed on the barren, rocky planet, in many ways a twin to Earth. The U.S. remains the only country to land successfully at Mars. If all goes well next February, Perseverance will become the ninth U.S. spacecraft to operate on the Martian surface. And the United States will bring 6,400 troops home and move another 5,400 troops from Germany to other countries in Europe. NATO originated in 1949. West Germany became a member in 1955. The purpose of the alliance was to confront the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper.
The broad strokes of these moves are as follows. First, various United States headquarters will be consolidated in locations in Europe outside of Germany, including, in some cases, co-locating at the same locations as their NATO counterparts in Belgium and Italy. This will strengthen NATO and improve the operational efficiency and readiness of over 2,000 service members in these headquarters. Second, the nearly 4,500 members of the 2nd Cavalry Regiment will return to the United States as other Stryker units begin continuous rotations farther east in the Black Sea region, giving us a more enduring presence to enhance deterrence and reassure allies along NATO's southeastern flank. Third, the 2,500 airmen based in Mildenhall, United Kingdom, who are responsible for aerial refueling and special operations and who had been scheduled to rebase to Germany will remain in the United Kingdom, thus ensuring the uninterrupted readiness and responsiveness of these units. Fourth, a fighter squadron and elements of a fighter wing will be repositioned to Italy, moving them closer to the Black Sea region and better capable of conducting dynamic force employments and rotational deployments to NATO's southeastern flank. In addition to these moves and the rotational forces announced by President Trump and Polish President Duda in 2019, we also plan on rotating forward the lead element of the Army's newly established 5th Corps headquarters to Poland once Warsaw signs a defense cooperation agreement and burden-sharing deal, as previously pledged. There are or may be other opportunities as well to move additional forces into Poland and the Baltics. Our aim is to implement these moves as expeditiously as possible, consistent with the principles I set forth.
Secretary of Defense Mark Esper. Trump accused Germany last month of being delinquent in their payments to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO alliance, charges he reiterated today.
Germany is delinquent They're at 1%, they should be at 2%, and actually everybody should be at 4%, not 2%, because 2% is too low. But they're at 1%, and they've taken advantage of us for many years. And you think that's bad? They take worse advantage on trade. And I was all set to fix that, and then we got hit with the China plague. But we'll be fixing it.
And that's President Trump, retired United States Marine Major Danny Surgeon, author of the blog SkepticalVet.com, says Trump's plans to move U.S. forces into the Baltic states, newly minted members of NATO on the border with Russia, could cause a war.
If there is to be an accidental and unnecessary nuclear or serious conventional war, mark my words, it is likely to be in those Baltic states, because once we put those Baltic states, Latvia, you know, and Lithuania, you know, and Estonia, countries people in America can't find on the map, don't even know that they're in NATO, and certainly don't know that we are by statute treaty obligation to defend them up to and including, if necessary, local, regional, or, you know, catastrophic nuclear war. This is not in our interest to provoke there or to take the risk there of sort of an accidental escalation.
Past governments of Russia have expressed the fact that if they feel that they're going to be in a war, the first thing they're going to do is invade those, like they did in World War II, is move their military into those three countries so they would have access to the North Sea.
These republics that we've put into NATO, an anti-Russian alliance by its nature from its founding, they are former Soviet republics. So as of 1991, they were part of the Soviet Union and they touched the Soviet Union. Those same three states block Russia off from this pocket, this little sliver of Russia called the Kaliningrad pocket, which is basically between Poland and the Baltic states. So, you know, no one even realizes that there's a little sliver of Russia that's like further into Europe and it's divided by all this. Now, none of that means that I would support, you know, Russia just rolling its tanks into these places. But when we have a rational, a prudent, a sober risk calculus, you know, we have to realize, where is the juice worth the squeeze? Where is it worth taking risks? And I think as we saw in the Ukraine, specifically with Crimea, or in the Georgian-Russo War of 2008, there are kind of some fait accomplis because of our unwillingness to actually go to the brink of war, or our inability to project force everywhere so they can slip like paramilitaries in and fight these indirect sort of proxy wars. And it's a lot more difficult from 7, 8, 10,000 miles away.
What does this tell us about NATO?
NATO very well could and perhaps should have gone away upon the fall of the Soviet Union, because that was sort of its, you know, raison d'etre. That was its justification. And instead, we decided to, like, retask NATO as a tool, right, an American tool towards unipolar hegemony and the delusions and triumphalism that followed. So NATO was never designed to do missions like Afghanistan, which is part of why it's run into these expeditionary problems. And I would argue that at this current moment, in many ways, NATO is actually more of a force of instability than stability in Eastern Europe.
What is the role of Germany and their financial contribution to NATO? Is this just a straw man that was made up by Trump?
Trump has the potential to end up pushing the Germans, ironically, closer to the Russians, or at least dividing himself from Germany, which is the heart of NATO. It's the heart of the EU economically, demographically. One of the reasons that the Russians were so concerned about the reunification of Germany is that it had been a force for instability, because it's a powerhouse in Central Europe. So it had invaded Russia twice in the 20th century to the tune of 20 to 50 million deaths. So it was really hard for Gorbachev at the end of the Cold War to even allow them to unify. Now we have a president who is he cannot handle any criticism or even the perception of it for anybody. And so now if, you know, Angela Merkel is going to criticize him even in the most passive or passive-aggressive ways, you know, he's going to take action. The Polish and the Baltic states like America a lot more because they see our military and nuclear umbrella as much more useful than the Germans. So in the process of saying, I'm going to pull out of Germany, but I'm not sending the troops home, I'm actually going to move them east, ironically and paradoxically, he's actually escalating the situation, which, again, complicates this whole Russiagate narrative, which I think has never been as linear as it's made out to be in most media.
Do you think it has something to do with that?
Most Americans don't really understand the backstory. They're, you know, they're living paycheck to paycheck. This is complicated to the extent that Trump appears to have any sort of rational foreign policy. In many cases, it actually provokes Russia. The Russians, from a historical and cultural perspective, are terrified of, you know, American and Western in general troops on their border, in their sphere. I think this is only a formula for potential disaster. I don't think that this benefits Russia. It certainly doesn't benefit Trump. And here's the funny part. It doesn't even really benefit, despite what they believe, the Baltic states or the Poles, because in many cases this could form sort of an escalatory catalyst.
Danny Surgeon is a retired United States Marines major and author of the blog SkepticalVet.com. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Oregon Governor Kate Brown said today the federal government has agreed to withdraw agents from Portland, a move that would end the standoff with Trump's use of federal agents to attempt to crush protests in the city that began after the killing of George Floyd by a cop in Minneapolis. The Department of Homeland Security said it would maintain its presence until conditions improved, but Brown said Vice President Mike Pence had agreed to end the occupying force stationed at a federal courthouse in the city. Brown said that all agents from Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement would exit the area on Thursday. They'll be replaced by local police. And in New York, earlier this week, a march supporting the Black Lives Matter movement in Manhattan was interrupted by police who swooped in with an unmarked van to snatch a protester named Nikki. Protesters were left clueless about why it happened. And with reports that federal agents were carrying out similar operations around the country, the local city council person, Carlina Rivera, stepped in to find out what was going on. Today, Mayor de Blasio addressed the incident in his news briefing. He blamed NYPD brass for bad timing for allowing the warrant squad out to pick up the protester during the march.
First of all, a lot of us have watched in pain what's been going on in Portland, Oregon. And the fact that you see federal agents, federal officers, federal troops clearly doing inappropriate things meant to undermine our democratic process, that's just thoroughly unacceptable. So anything that even slightly suggests that is, to me, troubling, and it's the kind of thing that we don't want to see in this city. This is not Portland, and I want to emphasize what you see on that video is NYPD officers. There are no federal agents involved, nor would we be involved with federal agents in anything like that. So I think it was the wrong time and the wrong place to effectuate that arrest. The arrest, as I understand it so far, was for damaging police property. I want to affirm very clearly, no one is allowed to damage police property. That is a real offense. That is an offense that can lead to an arrest. And my message to everyone, if you're out there protesting, protest peacefully. You know, we are talking this week about one of the greatest recent American heroes, John Lewis, who epitomized peaceful protest and civil disobedience. There's lots of powerful ways to make an impact without damaging any property. If you damage property, it will lead to consequences. But that was not the time and place to effectuate that arrest.
Okay, so where and how should this person have been arrested, if at all?
Look, I will say again, it is the responsibility of the police if someone's committed an offense, and that's the warrant squad whose job is to follow up, to look for the right moment to do so. I think, again, that given this atmosphere that we're dealing with in our country and the real concerns people have, it just didn't make sense. It made sense to do it in a situation that was clearly not in the middle of an ongoing protest. Unless you're talking, obviously, about a particularly serious offense. I'll talk to the commissioner about.
And that was Mayor de Blasio. The protester was released earlier today, according to Rivera. More than 300 NYPD vehicles have been damaged to the tune of nearly $1 million since the citywide protest started in late May. 14 of the 303 vandalized vehicles were so severely damaged they had to be junked. Seven other vehicles are still in the shop while the remainder are back patrolling the streets. A number of protesters have been charged with hurling Molotov cocktails at NYPD cars in Brooklyn. Earlier this month, Saugerties, New York woman Samantha Shader, 27, pleaded not guilty to throwing a fuel-filled bottle at a cop car with four officers inside. The device didn't ignite and shattered two windows. Meanwhile, today, Communities United for Police Reform, represented by the Center for Constitutional Rights, filed a motion to intervene in a lawsuit brought by five New York City police unions, as well as corrections and firefighter unions, that seeks to block New York City from publishing officer misconduct and discipline information and roll back the repeal of Civil Rights Law 50A. Linda Perry has the story.
Ramarlee Graham was killed by police in his own home in the Bronx in 2012. Constance Malcolm is Ramarlee Graham's mom.
If we knew this information about Richard Hayes, the former officer that murdered my son, maybe we could have curbed this before it got to where he murdered my son. So 50 is very important, and we have to really fight to keep it, because we know, like I said, we need to know who is working in our community and why it's so important. Because a lot of these cops that has abused people and, you know, killed people, this is not their first rodeo. They have done this before.
The five NYPD unions, the police unions, along with the corrections and firefighter unions, are seeking to use the courts to roll back 50A. Darius Charney is staff attorney with the CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Among the biggest obstacles to positive change in policing in this city are the five New York City police unions. Whether it was their vicious opposition to the creation of an independent civilian complaint review board in the early 1990s, or their legal challenge to the New York City Council's landmark Community Safety Act in 2013, or the 11th hour attempt to intervene to stop the court mandated reform process in the Floyd versus City of New York stop and frisk case that same year, where they made almost the same baseless claims about reputational injury and collective bargaining rights that they're now making in their new lawsuit. These police unions have shown time and again that they oppose the goal of a more transparent and accountable NYPD that respects and protects the rights of all New Yorkers. Now, in this moment of national reckoning around racial justice and police brutality, the unions are seeking to reverse one of the most important steps forward on police accountability and transparency that we have seen in New York in a generation, which is the repeal of New York Civil Rights Law 50A.
What this lawsuit is just a backdoor way of trying to get a court to reconduct the balancing that the legislature already conducted.
Chris Cariello is attorney with Auric, Harrington and Sutcliffe.
That's just not how this system works. I don't think any of us thought the unions would take the L lying down, so to speak. But I think it's really beyond dispute that organizations like CPR, who fought for this victory, have a deep interest in showing up to defend it, to defend the legislature's decision and the way that the legislature conducted the balance in favor of the public interest.
Antonin Pierre is with Communities United for Police Reform, which was instrumental in the repeal of 50A.
But what's really at odds here is we're talking about safety and we're talking about power, right? So we're talking about what does real, transformative, clear community safety look like? What does it look like for Black and Brown folks to be safe in community? And we've got these police unions who are really, really about power, right? And they are about power for the sake, police power for the sake of police power. And there's a frame that is police power for the sake of community safety, but we know because of the ways that they stand in the way of community safety reforms, the fact that they are even in this legal fight shows us that this is not about community safety. It's not about what communities want. It's about maintaining police power.
New York City public advocate Jamani Williams.
Police officers are municipal employees. We have a right and, in fact, an expectation that we have the ability to see what's going on. People were shocked and stunned when they found out the disciplinary records of the police, the one police officer that had some accountability who killed Eric Garner. What happened with the officer, Richard Hayes, who killed Constance Malcolm's son. These people have records. And when these things happen, almost immediately, the victim's history is laid out in full display. Everything, if they ever stole bubble gum from a store, is laid out. And we are told that there should be no such transparency for municipal employees who are hired to enforce law, who have the ability to kill someone, and too often there isn't accountability. That makes absolutely no sense.
I just want to make sure we internalize the magnitude of the moment.
New York State Assembly Member Michael Blake.
With everything going on in New York City right now, and everything going on in the country right now, the NYPD and the other unions are literally trying to go ahead and ask a court, we should have more time for secrecy than less. And I think when we talk about how we explain this to the listeners and to the people, the level of audacity to say, I'm watching you drive into the people. I'm watching you beat people. We know you are killing people. We know these things are happening. In this moment, for them to be asking that is pretty outrageous. And I think, as simply put, the responsibility of how do we communicate this is, within 3 weeks, you're going to have people trying to ask the court, we should be given more protection. But the simple question is, when do the people get protection?
On August 18th, the court hears the plaintiff's request for a preliminary injunction in an attempt to extend the current ruling to prevent disclosure of the database related to police misconduct and or discipline. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And in Washington, the heads of Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook testified on antitrust law before a House Judiciary Subcommittee considering antitrust legislation. But most of the questioning revolved around the tech firm's role in politics. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin questioned Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg.
Their boycotters include a lot of big companies, including Patagonia, Levi's, McDonald's, VW, Heineken, and so on. But you seem not to be that moved by their campaign, and I just wonder what you think about what they're asking you to do.
We're very focused on fighting against election interference, and we're also very focused on fighting against hate speech. And our commitments to those issues and fighting them go back years before this recent movement. Since 2016, the defenses that the company has built up to help secure elections, not just in the U.S., but around the world, I think are some of the most advanced that any company or government has in the world now. We routinely now collaborate with law enforcement and intelligence agencies and are able to sometimes identify threats coming from other countries before governments are even able to.
And that's Mark Zuckerberg discussing criticism by Representative Jamie Raskin about the tech giants' hosting of alt-right and other similar groups to organize and influence U.S. elections. While GOP's Jim Jordan spoke about his belief that big tech was silencing conservatives.
Google and YouTube announced a policy censoring the content that conflicts with recommendations of the World Health Organization. Now think about that. The World Health Organization, the organization that lied to us, the organization that shielded for China. And if you contradict something they say, they can say whatever they want. They can lie for China. They can shield for China. You say something against them, you get censored.
Is technology and globalization dirty words? Edward Goldberg, a leading expert on the interplay between global politics and global economics, is author of Why Globalization Works for America, How National Trade Policies Are Destroying Our Country. He says what's affecting the economy is technology, not globalization.
Most of the country benefited from globalization, but some people were hurt. And those people hurt become Trump's part of Trump's coalition. And this is the problem. You know, everyone benefits from cheap jeans, as my examples, except the textile worker in the Carolinas somewhere who doesn't. So in that person, not specifically someone in Carolina, becomes part of Trump's anti-globalization coalition. It's what I call the refugees from globalization.
So what should we do? Because they've become a powerful force. There's a good tens of millions of them who voted for Trump.
One is education, of course, which is, of course, we greatly underfund. The other thing, of course, is retraining and jobs, which is part of education. The other thing to think about, you know, interesting enough, jobs have not really lost, American jobs have not been lost to globalization truly in the last 10 years. The job losses have come from automation. Let's take Trump using steel as an example. Trump's began his fight against China with the idea that Chinese are destroying our steel industry. China didn't destroy our steel industry in terms of employment. Automation did in terms of employment. In the 1970s, it took 10 people to make a ton of steel. Today, it takes one. Look at Rochester, New York, which used to be the king of camera making, and the Kodak Brownie. Now everyone has a camera in their iPhone. There's no need for Kodak Brownie. Or just even look at the supermarket everyone goes to every day. Used to be full of teenagers at the checkout counter. Now it's all scanners. That has nothing to do with globalization. It's pure automation.
Why do you think they're blaming globalization for something that's caused by automation?
It's easy to blame the other. When times are difficult, it's the easiest political, the oldest political dance in the world is to blame the other, the outsider.
What can you say to people who feel that they've lost their livelihoods because of globalization?
It's actually true. I'm not denying that. But we should have, you know, the fault is not globalization. Globalization is, I think, almost the economic and cultural version of evolution. It's been going on forever in historic times. It's not a new phenomenon. Okay, which the new phenomenon is how fast it's growing. What do we say to people? Well, you know, there's been a failure in government, which we don't want to recognize. The failure in government to realize that the economy shifted and retrain the folks to be part of the new economy. It's a failure in government to say the economy shifted, so we need a safety net, like in the Great Depression, for the people who have been hurt by it.
What advice would you give to somebody like Joe Biden or anybody else who might run against the president to undermine this very fanatically loyal base of people who've been damaged by globalization?
He has to speak honestly about it and talk about the failure in government. One of the big anti-globalist things have been actually going back to Ronald Reagan, where the government has no purpose. Well, the government has a purpose, as we've been seen by Teddy Roosevelt during the Industrial Revolution, or we've seen by Franklin Roosevelt in the Great Depression. And here the government failed with globalization and failed to manage the process. We need government to manage the process.
Were the Democrats more to blame, or the Republicans more to blame, or all of them?
Paul, you know, I don't know, and it's something I can't figure out. Who has their nose to the ground more than a congressperson who has to get his employment contract renewed every 2 years? Where were they when this great shift in the economy happened? I don't know who's more to blame, honestly.
Edward Goldberg is author of Why Globalization Works for America, How Nationalist Trade Policies Are Destroying Our Country. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, July 29th, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News from New York, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.